Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman whose intelligence is inspiring, as is her leadership on a whole host of issues that really matter to our country. Her name is Reggie Littlejohn. She is the founder and president of a terrific organization, Women's Rights Without Frontiers. And we have been collaborating in recent days on a new initiative, and I wanted to get her on to talk about it because I think it's of surpassing importance. Reggie Littlejohn, good to have you back with us at Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome. And thank you. Let me just say right off the bat, Reggie, for all that you do, and most especially for this new project. And I want you to talk a little bit about it. It has to do with the anaconda in the chandelier, as it was put recently in a Washington Post sports article column. Talk a little bit about who is the anaconda and which chandelier are they in and what should we be doing about it?
Well, Frank, I love that article, The Anaconda in the Chandelier. And what it's about is how the Chinese Communist Party just slithers its way into everybody's life without them knowing it. So, for example, in Europe, they have these Huawei phones. Well, that's an anaconda in your phone because that's connected to the Chinese Communist Party's Huawei PLA-sponsored network. You know, and then she said there's an anaconda in your T-shirt because your T-shirt is made probably with cotton from Xinjiang, China, East Turkestan, where they are committing slave labor and genocide against the Uyghur population there. And, you know, there's just myriad ways that the Chinese Communist Party is slithering into our lives with the intent, like the anaconda, to strangle us and eat us. That's what the anacondas do.
And Reggie, so this business about genocide in Xinjiang or East Turkestan, as it's rightly called, is of particular concern because were we to ignore it, we will certainly see it become even more egregious and almost certainly conduce to the ultimate consumption, as you say, of the rest of us, not just those Uyghur Muslims. So talk a bit about what you're trying to do with several of your roles, including with the Committee on the Present Danger China and Women's Rights Without Frontiers.
Well, Frank, you and I, the Committee on President Danger China and Women's Rights Without Frontiers, just launched the Stop the Genocide Games. So this has to do with the fact that the United States government has officially declared that China is committing genocide in Xinjiang, East Turkestan, and that they have no business hosting the Olympic Games, which is the most prestigious international event in the world. So we, you and I together, and you have been co-leading this effort, launched just yesterday the Stop the Genocide Game, initiative. And it's a wonderful thing. So what we did is we wrote an extremely, I think, hard-hitting letter, and I'm happy to talk about the contents of that, all the different human rights atrocities and environmental predation of the Chinese Communist Party are listed in just like a glaring list here. And it was signed by 108 people, many of whom are really the heads of organizations and the major luminaries. And we sent it off to the United States Olympics Committee, the International Olympics Committee, and a a long list of CCs, including President Joe Biden, Vice President Harris, Secretary of State Blinken, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell. You just go down the list. There's a long list of CCs, all of whom received this yesterday. So between the strength of the letter, the power of and the gravitas of the signatories and the people that we copied it to, we're hoping to get an answer within the next 10 days.
Mm-hmm. And the question will become, does the U.S. Olympic Committee want to stand with those who are engaged in genocide and these other crimes against humanity, or do they want to stand with the American people and with the athletes, who I'm quite confident won't want to be part of those kinds of genocide games any more than the rest of us want them to be?
Right. So we are asking them, our first ask is, please move the game. Okay. So there are a number of cities all over the world that have the infrastructure for a Winter Olympics because they've held them already in the past. In the United States, for example, we have Salt Lake City that held the Olympics. I think it was in 2002, the Winter Olympics, to move the games so that the athletes will be able to have a freedom games as opposed to a genocide game. But if they won't do that, then we're going to bend every effort to boycott the game. And that will be unfortunate, but it's something that's the ball's in their court. They can prevent this. They can move the game.
Now, of course, it won't be entirely up to the U.S. Olympic Committee. The International Olympic Committee is the ultimate determinant, I guess. And there's a lot of evidence that they are very much in the pocket, or let me put it this way, the Chinese are very much in the pocket of the IOC, literally in terms of using their corrupting resources, influence, and pressure. So this will be a hard thing. I don't think there's any getting around it. But the case that's been made in this letter, and Reggie, I really want to salute you for the leadership that you've exhibited on putting this together and getting a great team behind it, is that the case is unmistakable that you will be, as in 1936, when the Olympic Committee let the Nazis host the games in Berlin, you'll be legitimating, you'll be empowering, and you will almost certainly be emboldening the Chinese Communist Party to do even worse in the future. Don't you think?
I completely agree with that. I just think that when the Chinese Communist Party is committing genocide in Xinjiang, when they're doing forced organ harvesting, when they are the authors of the One Child Policy, where they prevented 400 million lives through forced abortion, forced sterilization, and infanticide, right, exactly. Forced abortions, all right? So these babies were babies that were wanted, that women were forced to abort. And they've instituted the greatest state surveillance regime and social credit system. You know, they infected the world with a pandemic. And, you know, something that continues to outrage me is the way that they stopped all internal flights from Wuhan, okay, when the virus broke out. So they knew that this is a bad thing, and they were protecting their own people, but they continued the international hot flights, and they tried to shame the world by saying that we were racist by not allowing flights in from China when they were not even allowing flights from within their own country. Okay,
Reggie, we're out of time, I'm afraid. I have to wrap it here. Let me just simply say this is an extremely important documentation of why this is a transnational criminal organization. Your leadership in all of these areas is deeply appreciated. I know you'll keep up the great work at the Women's Rights Without Frontiers. Next up, we'll speak with Congressman Tom McClintock.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to the man who makes this program possible, Fred Flights, the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy, a career intelligence professional who has served with great distinction at the Central Intelligence Agency and the United States State Department on Capitol Hill on the House Select Committee on Intelligence, and not least as the chief of staff for the Trump National Security Council. We're always glad to have him with us, but especially as he's got a very important piece that he ran at Newsmax yesterday on what happened when Congress resumed the practice of having, with the Biden administration's help, unclassified intelligence oversight hearings. And it's a fascinating insight, Fred, that you've provided into what is wrong with this picture, I guess is the way I'd put it. Welcome back. It's good to have you.
Good to be here.
So start with a little bit of the history here, Fred. The House Intelligence Committee and its Senate counterpart, for that matter, used to be pretty much nonpartisan, just the facts, ma'am, kinds of operations. That stopped being the case, particularly as Adam Schiff became the chairman of the House committee. Give us a flavor of what that transformation looked like and how the Trump administration responded to it.
Well, Frank, it's great to be here. There's no doubt that the committee has never been more political than it is right now. But it's not true that it has never been political. It's always been a political committee. And I think that that's a good thing because the House is a political institution. People have differences, partisan differences that they care about. When I was on the committee with Pete Hoekstra in the 2000s, there was enormous political bickering, but it doesn't come close to what Adam Schiff has done. So we had this worldwide unclassified threat briefing where intelligence agencies came and gave an assessment of threats from all over the world concerning a variety of nations. But I would like to just pause and say, Frank, I guess you've enjoyed it when the Chinese government, when their intelligence agencies had a worldwide threat briefing on what their intelligence agencies thought of the entire world. Well, you didn't, because the Chinese aren't stupid enough to do this. No matter how hard we try to have our intelligence agencies dumb down their assessments to make them unclassified, we give enormous insights on their thinking and priorities and capabilities by these briefings. They're a really bad idea. They've always been a bad idea. There was information on shortcomings on cyber defense, what we think the Chinese government is up to, their cyber attacks, their priorities. Our intelligence agency should not be saying this in public in any way. And Donald Trump was absolutely right to cancel this circus. And that's what it is, Frank. It's a circus that only helps our enemies.
I'm sure you're right. And it's regrettable because, Fred, well, I think you also, of course, are correct that the House Intelligence Committee is a part of a political branch. It has, in the past, it seemed to me, been the case that people who were assigned to that committee were more, generally speaking at least, you know, focused on the business of intelligence oversight rather than grandstanding for political purposes. And Adam Schiff is a prime example of the latter. And the politicization has clearly infected the community itself that they are overseeing. And, you know, you have been talking about this, warning about it for many years, as has Congressman Hoekstra, for whom you worked on the committee. Talk a little bit about what we're seeing in terms of the worldwide threat assessment that was the impetus behind this hearing, in how they've cast things that suggest the politicization of the IC.
Well, the good news is that they played up China as the major threat to our country. I'm glad that the intelligence community admitted that. But they also played up climate change as an enormous intelligence threat that requires more resources. And I'm just wondering why climate change is an intelligence threat at all, and how many of our scarce intelligence resources are we going to devote to looking at sea turtles and polar bears? It's always been a mistake. This is not within the intelligence community's area. I thought it was interesting that the briefings did not even mention the Abraham Accords, the successful peace process by Donald Trump that has really brought us much closer to peace in the Middle East. The reason is because the Biden administration is trying to airbrush the Abraham Accords from history and has an Iran-centric foreign policy. And that's another problem of these hearings. Administrations basically go over the prepared report and testimony to make sure that what is said in the hearings is consistent with policy. So you're not hearing an objective intelligence assessment. You're hearing the administration's policy parroted by intelligence officials.
Of particular concern in that regard, Fred, talk about diverting scarce resources into areas where they should not be placed. Talk about the focus on the domestic terrorist threat that the intelligence community has now apparently been told must become a priority for its capabilities and funding. This is worrying on a lot of different levels, but start with the point that it's a misallocation of those scarce resources.
Yeah, this is a great question, because on Wednesday at the Senate Intelligence Committee, it was a love fest by Republicans and Democrats for the intelligence community. I was ashamed at the Republicans for not calling out the intelligence community for various ways where they're not doing their job and politicizing intelligence. But in the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, the top Republican, and other Republicans, they went after the intelligence community hard on efforts by the left and the Biden administration to weaponize our intelligence, to spy against who they call domestic insurgents, who are really their political opponents. John Brennan says, Frank, that those domestic insurgents include a terrorist group called libertarians. This is serious business, that we would be misusing our powerful foreign intelligence agencies that are only supposed to spy on foreign threat to target the Democrat political adversaries in this country. And the only good thing that came out of the House Intel hearing is that the Republicans really used it to come down hard on this issue.
Good. I hope that it will have some salutary effect on the community itself, because if they persist in this, Fred, I think there's all kinds of opportunities for abuse and real threats to our country. We're sort of devoting this program to talking, as we often do, about the fundamental transformation of America that Barack Obama promised back in 2008, and it seems to be very much the animating force behind a lot of what the Biden team is doing, and this would be one of the places in which that could be most profound in terms of its impact. Let me come back to Iran with you, Fred. You've devoted much of your professional life to tracking what the mullahs are up to, specifically with respect to their nuclear weapons capability, but also their support for terrorism. They've been deemed by successive administrations to be the world's worst state sponsor of terror. Talk about what the intelligence community is assessing with regard to the threat from Iran and what it suggests about the policies of this administration, since they definitely seem to be tracking pretty closely.
I think the intelligence community is in bed with the left on the Iranian nuclear program. They're playing it down. They're supporting the nuclear deal with Iran. And look, I think they're simply hopeless, this administration, the U.S. intelligence community. Look, that's why Israel decided, in my opinion, to sabotage, massively sabotage this uranium enrichment site recently, because Israel's not going to wait for this administration to do the right thing and to defend its interests. Israel has decided it has to take its security into its own hands, as it has throughout its history.
What do we know about the damage done to that Natanz facility, Fred? This is, of course, not the first time Israel has evidently gotten inside it. And some of the other nuclear weapons-related assets of Iran as well, including a treasure trove of information about their program. But it does seem as though this was a bit more aggressive and destructive. What can you share about that?
Well, this facility had thousands of machines. It spun a gaseous form of uranium at high speeds to produce fissile material, either for weapons or for reactors. Supposedly it's for reactors. They're very fragile. If they're shut down suddenly or subject to an explosion, there can be catastrophic damage to hundreds of thousands of them. I don't think this was just a cyber attack. I think it involved operatives on the ground blowing things up. Apparently, there was catastrophic damage to the power system associated with the Natanz facility. Did enormous damage, set off fires. And I think that they probably, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I think claims that they could be set back 9 months to a year are probably accurate. And the claims by Iranian officials, that they're going to quickly restart and start enriching uranium to higher levels. I just don't think that's true.
And to come back to the administration policy, Fred Pleitz, we certainly see evidence that they are redoubling their efforts to entreat the Iranians to allow them to re-enter this Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as it's called. What's the state of play with respect to that and the important sanctions that have been in place, notably those reinstituted by your old boss, Donald Trump?
The Iranians have said they want all U.S. sanctions lifted, including over 1,000 placed by President Trump. Isn't that great? 1,000 sanctions against Iran. And in exchange for that, Iran will stop some of the violations of the agreement that they've engaged in since 2019. Not the massive number of violations identified by the Israelis and documents they stole from Iran. And it looks like the Biden administration is prepared to do that. I think that they want to do it in stages. But at the end of the day, they're so obsessed with rejoining this nuclear deal and reversing something that President Trump did, they're going to get back into the deal, despite growing bipartisan pressure on this administration not to re-enter the deal without major fixes. I frankly don't think the deal can be fixed, but this is a move that's going to attract bipartisan opposition.
Good. Let's hope it stops it. Fred Vleitz, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time today and for the great work that you do. It's most appreciated. Next up, we'll speak with Congressman Tom McClintock about border insecurity and what it means for all of us right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Tom McClintock. He represents with distinction the people of the 4th District of California in the House of Representatives. Among other things, he is the ranking member, the top Republican, on the Subcommittee on Immigration and Citizenship of the House Judiciary Committee. He has just recently made an inspection tour of the border and has, I'm afraid, a very disconcerting report on what is happening there and what it means for all of us. And we wanted to take stock of that and other issues with him quickly today. Congressman, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Frank.
Let's start with what you saw on the border and how it has informed some of the things you've been warning about for some time concerning what's been called the Biden effect on our southern border specifically, and more generally, our immigration and border security policies.
What I saw was a country without borders. We watched literally hundreds of people emerge from the brush, and this goes on 24/7 down there, simply walk up to Border Patrol officers, get in line, and after a brief processing, some are taken directly to transportation hubs, and the rest are processed into the country in just a few days. I mean, if you can claim you're under 18 or you're in the company of a child under 7, you're in. And I mean, flying out from McAllen, Texas to Houston the next morning, there was a large group of illegals with their destination envelopes on my plane out of McAllen.
We don't know what their physical condition was with respect to COVID in many cases, I believe. And we don't necessarily have an idea where they're going to wind up either. But we do know that they will become wards of the state, do we not? And our healthcare system and education system and welfare and so on.
Where they will end up is every community in America. They're going to all points. One of the Border Patrol officers said, you know, our border is your border. Every community in America is now going to be a border community. It's going to be felt in classrooms that are packed with non-English speaking students, in crowded hospital emergency rooms as illegals demand medical care. It'll be seen in higher crime rates as the gangs proliferate. And it's going to be most of all, I think, felt as depressed wages for working Americans. And the Democrats are saying this is a good path. In Nancy Pelosi's own words, we're now on a good path.
Let me ask you about the sheer numbers. You made an observation in a press conference you had after you visited Mission, Texas on the 6th of April, that Border Patrol had 170,000 encounters with these illegal aliens. And that doesn't take into account, of course, the numbers that they didn't encounter. You pointed out that the equivalent population would be that of a city the size of Salem, Oregon.
Yeah, Salem, Oregon is about 170,000.
I think it's really important to get that into sort of calibration.
that's an exponential increase from February. We had 100,000 total encounters with the Border Patrol in February. That's the population of South Bend in 1 month. It goes to 170,000 in March. As you say, that's the population of Salem, Oregon. And by the way, that doesn't include the 155,000 estimated gotaways so far this year. And
is it your expectation, Congressman Tom McClintock, that if something is not done to change course here, that we're going to continue to see this kind of exponential rise, at least until sort of the summer kicks in and it becomes just more difficult to make the transit through the desert?
Oh, yes. And the Border Patrol is warning us this is going to get much, much worse. Gallup did a survey of folks living in Latin America and in the Caribbean. According to their polling, they estimate 42 million people are just waiting to come to this country once the borders are open. And now the borders are open and they are coming.
And that's just the people in Latin America, to say nothing of people elsewhere around the world. Let me ask you about one piece of this. Speaking of people from around the world, one of our colleagues, Todd Benzman of the Center for Immigration Studies, has written a terrific book called America's Covert Border War. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And he warned in that book, which was written before the Biden effect kicked in, of the numbers of people who will be coming here, not just for, you know, economic opportunity or to get away from gang violence or whatever other pretext they may use, but who are coming here to do us harm. Specifically, he was talking about jihadists, but they're not alone. What are you hearing, sir, as a ranking member of the Immigration Subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee, about the problem that we're having with people who may, well, you know, have those intentions?
Well, unfortunately, we're going to find out. As you know, two Yemenis on the terrorist watch list were apprehended in San Diego. Those are the ones we catch. And by the way, I suppose you could say, well, they're coming here to do work Americans won't do. But it's, they're certainly not coming to pick lettuce, that's for sure.
We don't want to make light of this. This could be doing work that would kill Americans, in large numbers.
That 155,000, those are the people who actively evaded the Border Patrol. So they're not counted in the encounter groups. We know absolutely nothing about them. But if right now you want to come into the country illegally, just line up. Those who are evading the Border Patrol, they've got something to hide. And how much of that is going to be felt by Americans in the future is speculation right now, but it's coming and it's going to be ugly. You mentioned one other thing, they're trying to get away from gangs. A Border Patrol officer told the story of confronting a mother who brought her 5-year-old little boy on this terrible 2,000-mile journey. He said, why would you expose your little boy to such danger? And she says, well, to get away from the gangs and to get him a better education. And the Border Patrol officer said, do you understand? Those gangs are already here. They're in communities across the country. Your son's going to be put in a school where he doesn't understand the language. He's going to be socially isolated because he's not accustomed to the culture. And for protection and acceptance, he's going to be turning to those very gangs you're trying to get away from.
Tom, very quickly, because I've got a couple of other things I'd like to hit to get your thoughts on as well. What would you recommend we be doing about this border situation right now?
Restore the Trump policies. They were working. The numbers speak for themselves. The week of the election in 2020, 100 family units illegally crossed the border. By the inauguration, that figure had increased to 1,100 in 1 week. The week ending March 24th, that number had grown to 14,000. That's the Biden effect you're talking about. When he canceled the Remain in Mexico program, when he ordered the border wall be abandoned, when he ordered ICE not to do their jobs and deport illegals who have been ordered by courts to be deported, when he did that, he sent a very powerful message. If Gallup is right and there are 42 million people coming, that is a mass migration of historic proportions, and no civilization has ever survived such a phenomenon. History is screaming this warning at us that countries that either cannot or will not defend their borders simply aren't around very long.
This is a central point, and unfortunately, I fear that it is the intent of those who are trying to do this to our country, to fundamentally transform it, demographically as well as politically. And shame on us if we can't stop them from doing it. Congressman, let me turn to something else that we need to be stopping. And I commend you for standing up and saying so in a recent, I believe it was a Judiciary Committee conversation about reparations, which you describe the bill as evil in its intent and certain to divide us. That seems to me to be absolutely indisputable, but you got a lot of pushback from Sheila Jackson Lee and some of her colleagues. Give us just a quick assessment of where we are on this idea that all of us need to pay certain groups reparations and the fact that some of this now seems to be moving inexorably forward through the Congress.
Well, you know, as I said, history offers us an inexhaustible supply of grievances and injustices that are powerful enough to stoke hatreds and resentments that can tear any society apart. And that's what the reparations movement is all about. And remember, these are not reparations from those responsible for slavery to those who were actually enslaved. This bill contemplates doing something radically different, holding people of one age accountable for sins that preceded them by 150 years. That is an outrageous injustice. And what they're trying to do is to set neighbor against neighbor, American against American, on the basis of their race. And the commission that they're setting up in this bill is entirely appointed by the Democrats. So its intent is laid bare for all to see. And what they're literally doing is reaching into the dead past, reviving its malignant conflicts, and then reintroducing them into our age.
For the purpose of dividing and hopefully, they think, fundamentally transforming our country.
That is certainly its effect, if not its actual intent.
I fear it's both. Quickly, we have an interesting drama playing out. Legislation was introduced, I believe, yesterday to pack the Supreme Court. Nancy Pelosi seems to think she doesn't want to be doing that legislation right now. Is this just a stay of execution, sir, or a commutation of sentence?
Well, the Democrats were very clear on their objectives long before the election. I mean, it's not like they kept this a secret. Their agenda is to pack the Senate with additional states, pack the Supreme Court with additional seats, rig the election laws, and open the borders. And they're well on their way to accomplishing that. If they do, that's game, set, and match for the country. There's no way back from that. Elections simply won't mean much in the future if they are successful. And they're playing for all the marbles. And I don't think a lot of people clearly understood that during the election.
Tom McClinic, we have to leave it at that. This is a topic to which I hope we can return with you very soon, though, sir. Thank you for your service to our country and for joining us here. It's great to have you with us. Next up, Jenny Beth Martin. More on elections and whether we'll have any in the future. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's a delight to say we're joined by one of my favorite people. She is Jenny Beth Martin. She is the honorary co-chairman and a founder of the Tea Party Patriots, an extraordinarily important organization that, a decade or so ago, changed America and is still a very important force for good in our country, and thanks in no small measure to her leadership. She has devoted much of her time of late to trying to address issues of election integrity or the lack thereof, particularly in the 2020 elections and most especially in her native state of Georgia. And not surprisingly, she has been very much in the forefront of the effort to fix problems that were identified in the process and to defend legislation aimed to do just that. And we wanted to catch up with her and take stock on how it's going. Jenny Beth, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have you.
It's great to be with you, Frank.
The Georgia legislation that you helped shepherd through the House and Senate down in the General Assembly and through the governor's office as well, has, of course, become a matter of histrionic attack, I think it's fair to say. Give us a flavor of what's in that bill, why it's important that it be enacted, and why it's engendered such controversy and opposition.
Well, Frank, the bill, I think that if people actually read the bill, they would agree with probably 95%, maybe even 100% of what is in this bill. So I'm not quite sure why so many people are upset about this new law in Georgia. But never.
Well, for one thing, they're not reading it. That seems pretty clear, isn't it?
Right. They're not reading it. And they are just lining up on party lines. And if you are not a Republican, you hate the legislation automatically. And as we have learned all too well over the last several years, the opposition, our opposition, automatically calls us very vile names when they can't find anything of substance to disagree with us on. But here's what this bill does. It actually makes it easier to vote in Georgia, and it makes it harder to cheat. Now, the people in the opposition would say that, and I've seen ads, which I think will be important as we talk a little bit in a little bit more in this discussion, about how they want to protect voting rights in Georgia. Well, you know what, Frank? I do too. I think that it is a sacred right to vote. And as United States citizens, it is a right and a privilege for us to be able to do that. I have no desire to make it needlessly difficult for people to vote. So I can agree with our opposition on that. And this bill has expanded early voting and actually mandated more days for early voting, including additional Saturdays and optional Sundays. On top of that, in the last election cycle, we used ballot drop boxes for absentee ballots. Not every county had those. So this bill ensures that and mandates that every single county will have absentee ballot drop boxes. These are things that people across the aisle.
And they will be secured.
They will be.
Which is another thing that was not true in the last go around, right?
Right. And these kind of things that I just mentioned are things that people on the other side of the political aisle wanted. And I think the Republican majority in the Georgia legislature made a good faith effort to make this something that had bipartisan appeal, even if it did not have bipartisan votes. What they also did is they secured the election and they improved the safeguards on the election in Georgia. I think it's a sacred right to vote, and I think our ballot is a product of us exercising that sacred right to vote. So I want to make sure that my ballot is secure. So those drop boxes have to be outside of a voting location or an election board office, and in the evenings they have to be removed and put inside so that nobody can go pour water in them or do anything that would tamper with the ballots. They also got rid of signature verification in Georgia for absentee ballots, but which the Stacey Abrams and the Democrats did not like and wanted change before our last election. And they improved absentee ballots by requiring your driver's license number or a voter ID number. And we give voter IDs away for free in this state if you need it. So it makes it easier to vote, but it makes it much more difficult to cheat.
Which, as you say, everybody should be in favor of. Yeah, of course. The point that I think really needs to be made here, Jenny Beth, is that for all those who are yelling about voter suppression, if you don't take these sorts of steps, there is going to be voter suppression. It's going to be your vote, quite possibly, that is suppressed because you will be disenfranchised by people who are not entitled to vote, but nonetheless are able to do so. So this is a really important effort, and I commend you and your Tea Party Patriots for the role you've been playing in championing it. So let's talk a little bit about specifically what these so-called woke capitalists are doing to engender, such opposition to it. You had a piece in, I believe it was Town Hall the other day, in which you sort of laid this out. Just give us the short course on who are these so-called woke capitalists and what's animating them?
Well, the woke capitalists are people who are using corporations to and putting pressure on corporations to enact a political agenda. And a lot of the political agenda is virtue signaling. It's a bunch of virtue signaling. For instance, they put pressure on the Major League Baseball to pull the All-Star game from Georgia, which did happen. But it is a bunch of virtue signaling. The Major League Baseball is saying, well, we want everyone to be able to vote and we want to have access to voting. Okay, great. I don't disagree. We want to make sure that I said that earlier, so I don't have to rehash that. But the fact is, Georgia's voting is better than Major League Baseball's state where they are headquartered in New York. We have more early voting. We have absentee ballots that do not require an excuse. It is they put out a statement to make people feel good. They pulled the All-Star game and it will have $100 million effect in Georgia and in the Metro Atlanta area. And why? For what? For what? They did it just so that they could get people on the left to be quiet, when in reality, the state where they're headquartered, they ought to go start in their own backyard if they want to fix things.
Let me ask you, Jenny Beth, about two other ulterior objectives here, it seems. One is trying to not only cow Georgia, but to make an example of it so that no other states will do what a number of them are now in the process of doing, namely trying to enhance voting integrity. But secondly, I'd like you to close us out by talking about what's going on at the federal level and how all of these efforts to engage these capitalists and their money and their political power has really a focus on the so-called H.R. 1 or S.1 now in the Senate election legislation.
Well, here's what, very, very quickly, a high-level overview of what happened in Georgia. There were organizations on the left that sent text messages to Georgia voters urging them to click through and sign a letter to CEOs of Georgia-based Fortune 500 companies. Then the same organization and a coalition of organizations, which included Black Lives Matter, took out an ad in the Atlanta Journal and Constitution and publicly listed the email addresses of the presidents, the CEOs, and the chairman of the board of Delta Airlines, the Home Depot, and other Georgia-based companies. Those companies within 24 hours of business days, not 24 real hours, but within a business day, put out statements that appeased the left. So the left felt emboldened, and we saw what happened with Major League Baseball. Well, now the left feels even more emboldened, and Fortune 500 CEOs and past CEOs are getting together last weekend on a conference call to figure out how they can put pressure on Congress, the similar kind of pressure to get H.R. 1, the Corrupt Politicians Act, passed into law in Congress.
And this legislation, this Corrupt Politicians Act, as you call it, would effectively finish off free and fair elections in this country. Make no mistake about it, folks. And as we've been talking about throughout the show, this is about fundamentally transforming our country. And we must not let them get away with it. And if they don't, Jenny Beth Martin, I know it will be in no small measure thanks to your leadership and great work and that of the Tea Party Patriots. I know you'll keep it up. I hope you'll come back to us with updates as this progresses, or better yet, as terminated. Thank you for your time and your great leadership and your friendship. It's really appreciated as well. I hope that the rest of you will come back to us again.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.